into another episode of Cult Film Cafe Does Christmas. And of course, it is me, Jonathan, one of your hosts. And as always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Kenzie.
Hello there.
So on this episode, we will be taking a look at 1946's Christmas fantasy drama, It's a Wonderful Life, directed by Frank Capra.
Look, who are you?
I told you, George, I'm your guardian angel.
What is it you want, Barry? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
Welcome home, Mr. Bailey.
Sentimental hogwash.
I wish I had $1 million. Hot dog! Mr. and Mrs. Martini, welcome home.
This is what I wished for.
You see, George, you really had a wonderful life.
Gets his wings.
That's right. So, yes, another oldie, but this is what one of the films that, well, most people rate as the best Christmas film of all time.
It's always brought up, I think. If you mention, like, there's certain films that are always brought up when you talk about Christmas. That is Home Alone, It's a Wonderful Life, Die Hard, A Christmas Carol.
You had to throw Die Hard in there just...
Because all those fans, all those people who are not really fans of Christmas films, they watch Die Hard. And that's how that whole... So Die Hard's got big enough to be its own kind of thing. It sits in its own city. But
sits in its own city? Fucking hell. Right. No, it's not even... Well, it's considered to be one of the best films ever, greatest films ever, as Wonderful Life. Not even just Christmas films. Yes. I have never seen it before. Like I've said, previous episodes and quite a lot, I need to watch old Hollywood, old movies, and I'm slowly but surely picking some off with this series. This is another oldie. Came out in 1946, as I've said. Yeah, an interesting one. I was always sold on what the kind of twisty element is on it, and I was shocked to find out that for an hour and a half, this film's just like an ordinary film. It takes so long to get to the inciting point, is what you would maybe call it in a movie. Were you surprised that it took that long to get there?
I didn't know what the film was about. I mean, I had heard you say a bit about it. If I knew what the film was about, I maybe would have been a little bit surprised. But not many films do it this way, where like the actual kind of punchline to the film doesn't happen till like the end of the film. But it's kind of I like that it does it though, because it works for the film a lot better. The fact that you get to see like this guy's life through the whole thing. I mean, it does start at the very start really peculiarly, where it's like angels talking, but it's like stars, very bizarre. But yeah, and then it goes straight in, follows life up until that point. Except the film could have maybe, because I think a lot of films would have done it this way, is they would have maybe started it with him at the bridge. I think that's a modern day thing. This is what they would do now, is they would start it with him at the bridge and then go back and stuff like that.
So they would start with like a flash forward?
Kind of, yeah, pretty much.
That's kind of more of a modern trope, I suppose, in cinema. Well, both cinema or film and TV. Yeah, interesting. I spoke to my dad about it when I seen him a few days ago, and I'd watched the first hour and 30 minutes, so I'd just got to the point where he was on the bridge. And I was like, right, so this is obviously where the film changes. But up until that point, I have a really good time. See, this is the thing about old cinema, is this film is, what, 2 hours and 10 minutes-ish, something like that?
About that, yeah.
But it spans this guy's whole life, pretty much. Up until
the point, yeah.
Marriage, kids. And it moves at such a frenetic pace, this film. It is unbelievably just keeps going and going. Like, I never got disinterested in terms of the pace of this film at all. It's just paced great, just keeps going and going. And I'm guessing that's just kind of what happens when you span like years of somebody's life in such a short space of time. I really, really did enjoy this film. I'm a sucker for black and white as well. Not a huge fan of old aspect ratio.
This one's not too bad. I've seen thinner ones. Like I feel like Miracle was slightly smaller. I think
possibly, yeah.
So you watched it? This film was obviously filmed in black and white. The version I watched of this film was recolorized.
Okay.
I instantly could tell. I didn't know this film was in black and white, but I was watching it, and I was like, the colors like it's recolorized quite well, but you can still tell. You can just tell it's recolorized. It just, I don't know how you can. It's just got this weird kind of look to it, kind of grainy-ish colors. It's like the colors are almost slightly dull, but very like vibrant. I don't even know what I'm saying now. At this point, I'm sounding kind of like an idiot. But you can just, but pretty much, if you watch any like kind of recolorized film, you can tell it's recolorized. But yeah, the version I watched was colors, and I don't think it affected the film. Be interested to watch it in black and white, but the recolorized version was quite good.
I didn't even know there was a colored version of it. I just assumed it was black and white.
Well, it's obviously like been done more recently. Like it's not like it's, yeah. It's weird, but yeah, let's go.
So yeah, the film is based off of The Greatest Gift by Philip Van Doren Stern. It's a short story, which he spent a lot of time trying to get sort of out there. He was trying to get people to pick it up, but it was unsuccessful. And eventually he sent it out as Christmas cards, like 200 or something. And it got into the hands of the studio who picked it up. I think they spent $10,000 on it, I want to say. Which, I mean, that in the 40s is a hell of a lot of money. But they then, so yeah, at RKO, they then sold the rights to Frank Capra, who then obviously went on to produce and direct the movie. The movie cost $3.3 million in 1946. $3.2 million. $3.2 million, sorry.
Is that a lot for the time, or is that quite small?
Well, it made $3.3 million, that's a lot of money. Like $3 million for a movie. That must be like, I mean, what's the conversion? I normally, what,
for like 1946, this is how they usually do, eh?
Well, this is, because the main series of the podcast is, one of the talking points is this, but
1946. When watching it, actually, I was watching it with my friend friend Moxie. We were converting how much $8,000 was at that time, which it was like $120,000 or something like that. It's kind of crazy to think about how big inflation and stuff has been over this. How many years it's been? What, like?
It's actually not. It's not as much as I thought it would have been.
How much?
It's just shy of 50 million.
Well, that's more than I thought it'd be. 50 million.
Just under 50 million. Which, like, I've brought up numerous times that movies for in that ballpark don't get made anymore. It's crazy.
What, the middle one?
Just the middle ground. Some do, but few and far between. Anyway, the film stars James Stewart as the infamous George Bailey.
Infamous?
I don't know. I think people know the character name.
I don't know if he's infamous, but he's probably more famous than infamous. I don't know if he's a bad guy.
Well, the famous George Bailey. I think people know the character name even if they haven't seen the film. I did, and I'd never seen it before.
I didn't.
Well, you didn't. His life is a bit shit because for the whole sort of first, I don't know, like 45 minutes or so, maybe not as long as that, he's constantly saying, I'm going to go traveling, I'm going to do this, I'm done. And he seemed to have a set out plan of what he wanted to do. But sadly, his father passed away. And the only way that they could keep control of the family business was if he took over as, well, I'm guessing, I don't know what they were calling him. Was he CEO? I don't know. It would be some form like that. Maybe just not that name. But that's the kind of, he was, the board were only willing to keep the control with the family if he took over. Which is a bit of shit because he didn't want to. He wanted to go. There was loads of points where everything just kind of went backwards. Like, even when he gets married and they've saved up like $2,000 to go on a honeymoon, he ends up giving the money away to people. He's just such a nice person.
Yeah.
Which is weird because he's kind of got like an off demeanor, but I don't know if that's either A, the actor, or B, just the way that he's played the character.
It's kind of weird. He's like, he is nice. He's very generous and stuff. He doesn't fully come off as being like the nicest person, I don't think, at times. But overall, he absolutely is. I just feel really bad for him. He doesn't really get anything he wants. He just does it because, well, he has to do it. If he didn't do it, like, what was going to happen? If he didn't continue his father's company, well, no, it was going away. That big guy that I forgot his name. Also, how has that big guy lived for so long? Like, what age is he? Like 2 million? He looks so old.
2 million. That's Mr. Potter, Henry F. Potter, who is the money man in Bedford Falls where they live.
Yeah.
And he wants to buy up everything. But essentially, the Baileys have got a building and loan company where they basically allowed people that wouldn't have been able to get their own homes, and that's where all the money's invested into buildings. And it's actually a really smart investment. It's just when shit hits the fan, but the problem is they don't have any like actual liquid capital to help people out with when the bank, when something happens to the bank. And then it even turns down a job that was paying him quite a sizable amount of money for back in those days, because it was for his arch nemesis, really. And it looked as if he was going to really contemplate taking the job, and then he eventually kind of snaps out of it and kind of goes, no, please.
I think it's you can see that's quite a good scene. I actually really liked that scene because I didn't kind of expect it to go that way, but because that whole time he's sitting there and speaking to the guy. When he's hearing all this thing, he's like, oh, he could get all this money and stuff like that. He's thinking about, at that moment, where he's like, this could be good, oh, all this money. He's thinking about what he originally wanted to do when he had his original plans. And he's like, oh, I could have all this money. Like, what he wanted to do, he was always dreaming big, get money, build massive buildings. This is what was in his head. And was when he hears that, it makes him think of that. But then he suddenly remembers, I can't do that. That's like already off the table. I need to work for the people and actually help the people out and keep his father's business going. And it's just a really good scene.
Because he knew. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
because he knows that if he'd done that and Potter gained control, he would have control of everything. And like we know from history, if somebody's in control of everything, things can quite quickly go awry if somebody's got all the power. And he obviously didn't want that. And obviously Potter is quite a sleazy, kind of only thinks about himself. Bit of a scumbag, because a bit of the time when Georgie's uncle loses the money, but he doesn't lose it. It's just, well, he does, but Potter essentially just keeps it and steals it.
Yeah, I mean, that's it just shows you how much of a dick that guy is. That part slightly annoyed me when they lose the when the uncle loses the money, because so he counts the money in that building, loses it in that building, and then has no idea where he lost it.
No, he counted the money in his office in the building and loans building. And when where he's losing it is the bank. He's just about to deposit it into
So he does go to a different building. I've been dumb.
So the building sitting in is, that's Mr. Potter owns the bank. So he's came into the bank. And obviously they've had that altercation. And he goes to deposit the money, but doesn't have it anymore. And that's when he tries to retrace his steps. Eventually goes back to the building and loans. George kind of finds out the situation, and that's obviously when George kind of asks for help and stuff. This is towards the end of the film we're getting now, because this is essentially the part where I think things are just boiling up, and then he snaps at his family. Bit of a dick move, not gonna lie. It's quite a shite scene where he shouts at all his kids and his wife and people on the phone, and he kicks the model, and you could just see him, he's just frustrated. And obviously when he thinks about everything, what he wanted to do is not the life that he envisaged, but I think deep down he knows that he's done the right thing, but he's obviously frustrated with life. And I think there's a lot of men, or not just men, a lot of people that get to a certain age, and if their life hasn't panned out the way they envisaged 20 years before, it can maybe be a bit of a shit reflection. And I think when you see just how, like, one of his friends became really really wealthy with the plastics guy, Sam Wainwright.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so because he asked George to get in, and George refused, and he probably should have. And his brother, Sam, that's not his brother. What's his brother's name?
Harry.
So Harry obviously goes off and, you know, he gets the Congressional Medal of Honor and all of that stuff. And he was a Navy fighter pilot and becomes a war hero. So he's kind of, his younger brother essentially went off and managed to travel around in the military. Not necessarily what George wanted to do, but kind of became something and kind of made a name for himself. And but I think over time, and obviously when the sort of twist happens and Clarence Oddbody appears, that was quite strange. Like, I've always wondered how visual and special effects worked back in the day. Because see the bit of the bridge where George is standing and all of a sudden he appears behind him?
Yeah.
It just looks so clean. Like, how are they doing that in 1946?
I actually don't know. I mean, it got some sort
obviously
of
obviously, it's maybe just the way it's shot, and maybe they've merged two shots together. But you think of some of the films that have got astronomical budgets now that look so bad.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, there's so many ways to do things now, and sometimes just people just don't do it right. Whereas, I guess back then, there was probably like only like one way you could do this, or they just don't do it at all, I guess. Like, it was very limited back in the 40s. I just want to know when Clarence, was his name Clarence?
Clarence Oddbody is his guardian angel, or whatever, he's his guardian angel.
Like, did he, but like, did he just like slash TP into the water? You don't hear like a big splash or anything. He's just suddenly in the water. I mean, I guess he could just teleport, I guess,
Yeah.
Like,
did he jump? I don't
know. Did he jump? I never saw him jump. Wait, maybe you do see it. Maybe I'm I just don't remember seeing it though. I just remember suddenly he was in the...
He does jump.
No, you see the splash. Jump, see the splash.
You see the splash.
Yes, you do. You do. Okay.
But you might not necessarily hear it because of how far down it is, you know.
Like, I think you would know.
I don't know.
I think you do hear it. You see the splash. I don't think you see him like cannonballing. I don't remember seeing him like cannonballing, but.
This is it. We might as well spoiler territory, but if you've not seen It's a Wonderful Life, please do go out and watch it. It's actually a really good piece of filmmaking. I really enjoyed it. But this is where the twist happens, and obviously it's quite bad that I'm really only talking about George Bailey, but this film kind of dies on his performance, you know, James Stewart and the character. He obviously builds up and eventually realizes that he's actually worth more dead than he is alive. So obviously he gets drunk, crashes his car, goes to a bridge, and is contemplating jumping off the bridge. So contemplating suicide. And then a mysterious person appears, turns out to be Guardian Angel Clarence Oddbody, who jumps in but knows that if he does that George will jump in to help him because he knows what type of man he is. And then obviously the person that watches over hears people scream and shout and helps him out the water. So they end up in this wee kind of cabin or kind of building where Clarence then kind of tells George who he is. And then the guy that goes on patrol, he ends up getting freaked out and leaves, and it's left with the two of them. And George eventually wishes that he was never born. And so Clarence goes, fair enough, and does it. And then eventually he goes out to try and see people and where he's living, and everything's changed. It's as if he's never existed. This is really, really closely related to A Christmas Carol.
Kind of, yeah.
Specifically, like, this part of it.
Kind of, yeah. It's different, but yeah, it's kind of like, you can see that there's somewhat similarity to it.
It's quite smart. I quite like it. It's quite a happy ending.
Cheerful ending, yeah.
It's a cheerful ending. Good.
It's very nice. There's not much to complain about this film. Is there anything you would nitpick at?
Who, me?
Yes.
My only gripe with the film is the demeanour of the main character. Because he's built up to be this like person that cares about where he lives and the community that he lives in, he can be quite abrasive. And I don't know if that's just the character dialogue. Everything, people speak at a million miles an hour in this film.
Old films, most old films, they speak at like times two speed.
And I think that doesn't necessarily help with you trying to find the sort of empathy with the character. Like, he is a good person, and I understand why he's a good person. But sometimes when he says things, he kind of comes off as a bit of a dick. But you know he's not, and it's quite. I'm not saying he's a hard character to root for, because he isn't, but he is sometimes as well. Because it's the stuff with Mary at the start. She obviously is in love with him, and he's so blasé about don't want to be tied down, all that stuff. And it's just like, mate, what are you doing? Like, you're not seeing what's in front of you. And I think it was all this. He didn't want to. He wanted to go and do his own thing. But then, eventually they do end up together, which is great. And obviously, for a long period of time, they were a great couple. It's just, obviously, life got to them to breaking point, essentially. And they obviously kind of became that. But that's my only one gripe with the film in terms of what I kind of felt was a bit odd.
I'm kind of similar, actually. I was going to bring up, there's a scene you brought up that I was also going to bring up, but I was going to say that I like that George has a slightly abrasive kind of abrasiveness to him, because it makes it much more believable in the end when he finally snaps. See, if he was just completely nice throughout the whole film, like just seemed completely joyful and just, or just there's not a bad thing about him, or like even a slightly off thing, like a little, when everyone's got flaws, if you know what I mean. If he had like no flaws, it wouldn't really feel right in the end of the film when he finally snaps at his like children and that, because it just doesn't seem like it'd be possible to do that. But the fact that he is slightly flawed in certain things, you kind of, you do see it. You do see that he doesn't really want to do what he's doing. He doesn't really have any interest. He's at certain points, so it's really, it makes it really good when he finally, at the end, he's just like, when he's finally like, I want out. I don't want to live here. I don't want to live there. It makes the whole journey of watching him through it work really well. My one complaint is the scene you actually did bring up. It's the scene when he goes to speak to Mary at her house. I don't understand why he was like that at all. It really confused me. Because sometimes he's slightly abrasive, but he was being pretty much like a dick. That whole scene was like really off. I couldn't quite understand why he was like it. Especially since watching the scene before, it made no sense. I know the scene very before is him getting like laughed by like a bunch, getting told he's weird or whatnot, but like, and maybe that's why he's like that. I don't know. That's the only scene in the whole film that I kind of had an issue with. I just feel like it fell off. It didn't feel right. But that scene still ends the way you want it to end, so it's fine. It was just a bit bizarre. But bar that, I don't think I have a single complaint about this film. I actually love this film. I can see why it's very talked about. It's seen as a Christmas film. Most of this film is not at Christmas. I don't know how people feel about that. I would still say it's a Christmas film. It's not a Christmas film. It's just an angel, actually. But it's kind of marketed as a Christmas film. It's a Christmas film. It's what it's seen as. It's been seen like that for over how many years. I don't think it'll be seen any other way. So, no, I did really enjoy this one. I was quite happy to leave this one, the last ones we've done as well. I was really looking forward to this one, because I really knew pretty much nothing about it, and I was very happy with my viewing. Great film.
Yeah, I mean, I think all three of the older films have been actually really quite good. You really enjoyed White Christmas. Miracle on 34th Street was good as well. It's just that it was a bit of a weird...
It's the least good out of the three.
Yeah, it's not... It's third and out of the three of them. I agree. I am glad that I've finally got around to watching this film. And I'm not disappointed at all. Do you know what? It's one of these older films, and I think one of the things I really liked about it is it's shot spectacularly well. They obviously built like a real Bedford Falls, like, and it's all kind of locational. There's something about filmmaking like that that I just love. I mean, I'm a big advocate for it if you can shoot on location. Maybe I never had an option back then, but they do now, and maybe they should use that option a lot more. In my opinion, I think the place kind of fit everything. Like it's such a great film. And another thing is everything was like technically like editing as well. Like sometimes in these older films, I've got a problem with the editing style, but in this, everything seems to be almost flawless. And sometimes films like this just happen where it's all the right people at the right time, and you end up with an end sort of production like this. And yeah, I don't have any other qualms about the film at all. And I, like Kenzie, I actually really did enjoy this film. true, yeah. I mean, we've spoke at length about it. We should maybe just wrap the podcast up by giving our ratings and then get the podcast wrapped up. Who do you want to go first?
You can go first.
Okay. I like it. Like, I'm just no bones about it. I really enjoyed this film. I was captivated. Never really looked away from screen. Like, you know, you've got loads of distractions these days. It's quite easy to look at your phone and stuff. Never done that in this film. I was kind of engrossed in it. And I think that's when you get a character like George Bailey, it can draw you into a film really, really easily. I think that's basically what happened in this watch for me. As soon as you buy into a character and kind of want to see what happens, I think you get hooked. I also think it's obviously the film spans a number of years, so it's not just set at Christmas. But obviously, I would still argue it is a Christmas film, 100%. And I think the whole... do you know what? What I like is, even in 1946, they were talking about subject matter and themes which are really prevalent now, specifically around about this time of year. So, yeah, it's also a major plus. One thing I did just want to say is I think the reason it's became such a popular film is for 20 years it was in the public domain, so networks could show it for free on the TV. And I think it was from like the early 70s to the early 90s.
Why?
Because it went out, just it fell into public domain.
Why is it now back out?
I don't know if somebody's picked up the rights or what's happened. I'm not really sure, but I just know that it was in the public domain for at least 20 years and obviously was shown at Christmas on all channels in America probably and the UK alike. So, I mean, it garnered the sort of maybe the sort of the critical success and the sort of way the audience think about it, you know, if more people are getting to watch it. I'm going to give this is quite high, but yeah, I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5 for me.
I really like this film. I've enjoyed all of the old films, especially White Christmas and this one. They're both really good. If I had to say which one's better, I would probably say this one. And you already know what I gave White Christmas, a 4.5.
Yeah.
So, the question is does this film reach a 5? That's the question. I was speaking to my friend, Moxie, because we watched this film together as well. He thinks it's a 5, and I think that's fair. I really like this film. Like, it's so good. Like, the journey of following it through his life. Like, the final part of the film, which is the whole kind of point of the whole film, that's really good as well. But that first part, going through, like, his whole life, I love it. It's so good. That's, like, my favourite part for me. And then the second part, the end's just kind of icing. I mean, you need it as well. Otherwise, the film wouldn't end. But, like, it's such a good film. I would recommend, even people who are not fans of old films, I would recommend watching this one, because I think it really, out of the three old films that we've watched, this one stands up the most nowadays, I would say. So, yeah, I'm still going to give it a 4.5, but I would say it's a higher 4.5 than what White Christmas was. I think this is the best out of the three old films that we watched. Why are you laughing?
Just it's another Kenzie. You've got your own wee metric within the metric, you know. It's like, oh, a higher one, you know, or a
this
lower
is hard,
one.
Like, because I don't want to go into decimal points. I just want to say that I would. It's where I would kind of put it. It's hard to. I'm not. I don't think I can give it a 5.
I'm actually surprised that Moxie gave it a 5, but then again,
he loves
it. I don't know what kind of films he likes. I mean. But yeah, it is a good film though. interesting to see another young person watching it and thinking it's a great film. So it just shows you that films do stand the test of time, specifically if they're made to this level. So you're standing by a 4.5, are we agreeing that it's a 4.5 out of 5? I just think Claws is better than every film that we've seen, so that's why I didn't give it a 5. But
I think you're right, yeah, I still feel like Claws is better. Claws is so good. Like, I don't know what it is about Claws, man. I really don't know what it is about it. I just really fucking like Claws.
It's like in a tier. It's like a tier all to itself almost. But we'll find out. We'll find out after. We've got another couple of films to do in the series, and then that'll be it. And we'll see where they get. I know that Kenzie's excited about one of them, so we'll see if it can maybe get up there. I know that it's going to be north of 4, but we'll see if it gets to the highs of a 5. That is it for another episode of Cult Film Cafe Does Christmas. This one could potentially be a long one. I don't know how much Kenzie's going to be able to cut this one down, but it's just one of those films that we had quite a bit to talk about, and we thoroughly enjoyed it. And as always, if you'd like to check out past episodes of the podcast, you should know where to find us by now. Just search Cult Film Cafe wherever you stream your podcast and you will find us. And if you go and give us a wee follow over on social media, that would be great. We are at Cult Film Cafe on Instagram and Twitter, and you can find us on Twitch at twitch.tv/Cult Film Cafe. Yeah, Cult Film Cafe everywhere for the podcast. So yeah, it's a pleasure as always. We will be with you for another couple of episodes to round out the Christmas special. And yeah, it's been a blast as always. It's a goodbye from me.
And this is all... fuck me. And it's a goodbye from me.
Podcast out.